everybody. I'm Craig from theoneliner.com, coming to you today from Falkirk in Glasgow via the wonders of Skype. We are joined by Scott Morris.
Hello.
And also via the wonders of Skype, and also from Falkirk, we have Drew Tavendale.
Hello.
This time we're going to be running down the top 10 films from November the 23rd to November the 25th, according to the UK film box office statistics, and we'll be throwing some other stuff in as well. So let's rock on and do this thing. How are we, boys? Everything all right?
Yeah, life's good.
Drew?
Things are okay.
Nobody's dead yet.
We try to avoid it.
Excellent. In that case, then, you guys should be able to offer some undead informed opinions on these films.
You're trying to create a pretty terrible link into 30 Days of Night, which is at number 10.
I wasn't, actually, but now that you've created that link for me, I might just steal it. On the theme of things which are undead, at number 10, there's 30 Days of Night. Scott, what's that jazz all about?
Well, we've covered this before, but vampires, ooh, terrifying, as they besiege a small town up in Alaska, and Josh Hartnett fights them off with a group of survivors, and we all quite like this, I believe.
Well, I was going to say, let's not be so facetious about the whole sort of ooh, frightening thing, because they were quite scary in this, weren't they, Drew?
Yes, they were, which is more than pretty much any horror film's done for the last 10 years.
Certainly any more so than any other vampire film since probably, I don't know, Nosferatu. I think we're all agreed on that one. We very much enjoyed it. If you like vampires and you like people getting their heads ripped off, go and see it, or else we'll send the boys round. At number 9, there is Elizabeth, The Golden Age. Drew, have you guys seen this one?
No.
No. As it's a film that seems to be primarily concerned with set dressing and costumes, it didn't really appeal a great deal to me, so given that
well, in time-honoured one-liner tradition, so we still cast vicious aspersions even though we've not seen it.
Man, it's drivel.
Yes, it's awful.
I think it's marginally more preferable than lung cancer. At number 8, we have Shrooms. Have you guys taken the time out of your schedule to indulge in this one? Because I know I haven't.
Oh, you laugh now. I actually have.
The full.
Oh, Scott, what have you done? Maybe, you know, impart your agony upon our listeners. What say ye of Shrooms?
A fairly dismal Irish horror effort, it must be said. We don't make an awful lot of horror films in this part of the world, and when we do, they tend to either be very, very good. When you get things like 28 Days Later or Dog Soldiers, that's something quite entertaining, or they go the other way and become very, very, very bad. Things like Creep, things like Devil's Gate. This is one of the latter.
Are we going to add Shrooms to that list?
Shrooms belongs in that little pantheon of utter terribleness. You have three couples going off into the woods, 5/6 of whom are dim yank teens, and there's one dumb English guy. They're off trying to get mullered on magic mushrooms and all stagger about giggling while some dude in a cloak stalks them, picks them off one by one with an axe in spectacularly unspectacular fashion.
We're living in an age where there are no more sort of pretenses on which to base a horror film, really, aren't we? They're scraping the barrel here.
Well, even this, I mean, as you probably know, we're in the middle of a writer's strike. I can only assume that this was the first use of the automated horror writer 4000 Otron, which has just pulled out something so utterly generic. It's really quite baffling to behold.
In all honesty, I have seen or read nothing of Shrooms other than the commercials on telly, but I'm guessing by your description of the setup, Scott, is the director of this film, the writer and director, trying to cast some sort of crazy mind game upon the audience where you're not quite sure what's hallucinatory and what's real?
Right, well, right, he does the thing that I hate most, and it's in every film with drug use, pretty much ever. Right, the character takes some sort of hallucinogenic drug, and all of a sudden the screen starts shimmering like it's in a flashback in Scooby-Doo or something, or someone smeared Vaseline over the lens. So, okay, fair enough, I understand that character is having a trip. I, however, am not and have taken nothing more powerful than Iron Brew all day. Why is everything suddenly going crazy for me? Why is that happening? It annoys me more than anything else, but it's really one of the least annoying things in this film.
Are you sure that perhaps they didn't slip some psilocybin into your Iron Brew, Scott?
I'm fairly certain that they didn't.
Okay, carry on.
There's some little pretense at artistry. There's the occasionally goes into this kind of washed out palette, the kind of bleach bypass thing. It looks a bit like it's out of Silent Hills. They do the kind of messing with camera speed, so it looks like a kind of scary, jerky motion thing going on. But in all honesty, it's fairly amateur hour stuff. There's a fairly obligatory, terrifyingly terrible twist ending. It's, every character in it is sort of uniformly unlikable. There's nothing to interest you in here. And because of its rating, it's fairly unspectacular deaths, which is about the only thing you could really have going for it at the end of the day. And it doesn't even deliver that. So it's a disappointment on pretty much every level.
That's a bummer, man.
It gets one bonus point for having a talking cow, and one of the characters is named Bluto, which I quite liked. But they're the only two positives that I can take from this horrible, horrible experience.
What about number seven on the list? We have August Rush. Again, I've been far too busy to check that shit out. Guys, have you seen it?
I only heard about it half an hour ago.
Yeah, I've been too busy to take any cognizance of what it even is, so we'd probably better just stumble on, I think.
Well, listen, we still have to cast aspersions, though. I think this one might be mediocre.
I suspect it'll be tedious.
I think it'll mostly be yellow.
Number six, we have the we have the Darjeeling Limited, Wes Anderson's latest quirky comedy come self-discovery movie. Scott, can you fill us in any more adequately than that?
Not at the moment. We will be getting round to seeing this, but not until next week, I would imagine. But
yes, we promise we'll see this one before next week.
Let's face it, if it's Wes Anderson, we'll like it. It tends to be how this thing goes. So,
in case you haven't guessed yet, listeners, if you have been listening regularly, you probably thought, oh, bit of a gap between this and the last podcast. The boys must be cooking up something special. Nah, this is a filler. At number five, at number five, Good Luck, Chuck. Now, this has been taking a bit of a panning in the press. Scott, you admitted that you did at least laugh quite heavily at it.
I can't understand why it would be panned. I mean, it does have the worst trailer I've seen in a good long while. It makes it look like a completely insufferable film, and I'd want to have no part of it.
Can I also say it's got the most poorly photoshopped poster ever either? Not that it's at all obvious his head's been stuck on someone else's body.
I had very little interest in it, but I like to take one for the team now and again, so I thought I'd give it a watch, and it turns out not to be too bad. Plot, as in case you've avoided it, you've got Charlie, who a fella called Dane Cook, who I don't think I've seen before, but I think he's grown from Ben Affleck's cells and just made a clone of him because he looks very similar.
He's just eating a few more muffins.
He is cursed as a child by some little goth chick. Okay. And whoever he sleeps with will then immediately meet their perfect mate and go off and live happily ever after. And he will forever remain miserable. Oh.
Oh, well. But yeah. He does get his end away quite often, so it's not all bad.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's the way it's played in the trailer, it looks like it's going to be a sort of an insufferable sort of him going around shagging everything that moves film. And it turns out that it isn't that. It's quite sweet in most places, with the possible exception of Charlie's best friend, Stu, played by Dan Fogler, who's a dirty, dirty pervert. Eventually, Charlie meets Cam, Jessica Alba, who's works in the zoo and is obsessed with penguins, who they fall in love, and then Chuck gets a bit upset because if he thinks he sleeps with her, he'll lose her, and yada, 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 yada. And you can probably fill the rest of the plot in for yourself, and it's an entirely adequate little film.
Fair enough. So you wouldn't not recommend it then, but probably not worth going out of your way to see.
No. What do you think, Drew?
I'd say, yeah, it's adequate. I also saw the trail at the same time, and my thought as it emerged was like, oh, this is awful, please don't make me watch it. But it's
you still went to see it.
Yes, but I'm stupid like that, as you know. It's all right, actually. Yeah, it's adequate. You know, it's one of those films that's going to entertain you for its 90-100 minute running time, and then you're going to forget about it almost entirely. But you're not going to feel gypped for having seen it. You laugh a bit. It's reasonably entertaining. It's not hateful, like, say, Death at a Funeral, the last comedy I watched.
Comedy in inverted commas.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, alleged comedy.
It steals its playbook mostly from Along Came Polly, where it has the kind of more or less standard sort of rom-com stuff going in the background, with just the odd moments of not quite bad tasting, but the odd sort of moment of fairly shocking out-of-character stuff, from the which would have been supplied by Philip Seymour Hoffman in this one, but this is from the Stu character, who's
probably quite an achievement then, if it's stolen its playbook from Along Came Polly, and by the sounds of it, well, Along Came Polly was crap, and this sounds like it might actually be halfway decent. So,
Along Came Polly is probably as good as this.
Stop.
They're both fairly mediocre. I can't say much more for them than that, but they're perfectly acceptable enough in their own little way.
Oh, I'd agree with that.
And number four, Ratatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatatat maybe a chef finds out there's some sort of prejudice in the workplace against rats, who'd have thunk it? hides under the hat of a young sort of, is he a trainee chef, an apprentice chef, isn't he?
Yes.
Who's actually quite rubbish at cooking, directs him as to how to cook properly. You do the math. It wasn't bad, but I didn't feel quite as engaged by it as I'd hoped for from a Pixar film, but then I was decidedly unimpressed by Finding Nemo as well. I seem to be the only person in the world that didn't like Finding Nemo. What did you think of it, guys?
Roundly average. I have no issues with it. Well, it's better than average. It's pretty decent, but there's no real flair to it compared to a lot of the other Pixar stuff, and it just sort of fills its time quite adequately enough. It's bad Pixar, still better than most other people on their best days, so take out of that what you will.
Yeah, it's, as we've discussed before, it's Pixar by numbers, but Pixar by numbers is better than pretty much anything else in the genre. It's just the last couple of Pixar films, like that and Cars, they're just not as engaging or as, it's hard to describe. It's just not as appealing and vibrant as their earlier films.
This is another Brad Bird directed one, isn't it? I think
yes.
Right, yeah. And the last, of course, that he directed was The Incredibles, wasn't it? I like what Brad Bird attempts to do in that he cranks the zaniometer down. There's not as much slapstick kicking about, and I think Brad Bird does genuinely make an effort to sort of focus more on the story than he does on zany laughs. And I think he tries to make something a bit more. A bit less hectically paced and more sort of thoughtful, but perhaps he's gone too far that way with this one, and the needle's gone too far to the other side of optimum, really, I think, hasn't it?
Yeah, there's certainly something to that. It's a sad thing to say, but it's just not as good as the rest of the other Pixar stuff.
Yeah, yeah. What I got the feeling watching it is that Brad Bird would actually probably like to make a film which isn't about sort of animal characters, and he'd probably just like to make a CG human drama sort of thing, and it's, you know, but he's contractually obliged by the whole Pixar thing to actually use sort of, you know, anthropomorphise something or other and stick it in there, whereas I kind of get the impression that, well, I mean, obviously with The Incredibles it was more of a family drama, really, wasn't it? But there's still all the sight gag stuff going on and the sort of the high concept nonsense of them being superheroes and things. I just get the opinion Brad Bird wants to be the first guy to make sort of like just a CG melodrama where nothing much happens.
The CG version of Dogville.
Yeah, exactly, on Golden Pond. You know, the CG remake.
The man was a consultant on The Simpsons for years and years, so I'm not really sure that's accurate. Although perhaps having done that sort of thing for so long, perhaps that's why he'd want to make a CG melodrama.
Yeah, exactly. I think
it's a change of pace.
I think Brad Bird should direct a CG remake of Brief Encounter. At number three, Stardust, which I hate to admit that I found myself quite enjoying in a way that I don't really want to admit to anyone, but I'm man enough to do so. You guys both enjoyed it as well, I think, didn't you?
Yes, without any feeling of shame attached to it either.
Fair enough.
Yep, no reservations. Quite a good little fantasy romp.
Take that as recommendation. At number two, Ray Winstone is camp to slash up a monster in Beowulf.
I'm Swedish.
Exactly, I'm Swedish by way of Camden. I've bought a chopper down the market. I got it off Ian Beale. I'm going to act up a monster.
Ricky!
I've stood on something, it's squished between my toes. What? it's plausible. You don't just think Ray Winstone's never stood on a bugbear naked or something, have you? I don't know what I'm talking about.
It's not something we'll find any thought to.
Well, I have, all
seriously.
Right. Yeah, that's all right, guys. You just flaunt about watching your films. I'll deal with the serious issues, yeah? Yeah, exactly. Has Ray Winstone stepped on something squishy or not in bare feet? And Beowulf, obviously, based on the... God almighty, it's a few years old, that poem, isn't it? Is it not about 2,000 years old or something?
Yeah, I believe
I think it's sort of medieval times.
Yeah, I think we're talking about 6th century. There's a good sort of millennia and a half behind it, I think.
Yeah. So it's got a bit of pedigree behind it. Now, this is another attempt at sort of... I absolutely cringe when I hear the word synthespian. To me, it kind of defeats the purpose. Although, to be fair, in Ray Winston's case, Ray Winston has done motion capture for a CG character who looks nothing like himself. But every other character in the film, I think Anthony Hopkins and Angelina Jolie et al., have basically just sort of lended motion capture to see highly sort of realistic CG models of themselves.
Yes, it all seemed very, very pointless.
Yes, exactly.
You're venturing quite far into the uncanny valley with this one.
Well, from what I can gather, though, it does at least lend some sort of weight to the, you know, the assertion that Angelina Jolie in CG probably looks just as good as real Angelina Jolie, and she does.
But significantly more expensive and difficult to render. So we'll run through this, in case you've missed the poem, which could happen, because I don't think I'd actually read it until I'd seen this film. Beowulf, Ray Winston, shows up as a badass warrior to save Hrothgar. Anthony, I'm Welsh, Hopkins being Welsh.
It suits him this time, doesn't it? He's only Welsh when it suits him.
Yes. It saves his kingdom from a big nasty troll called Grendel, who's being very, very truculent and killing people.
That's the first time I've heard a troll being described as truculent.
And lo, there's fighting and so on and so forth and cursing and all that kind of thing that's going on and on. And you can go and read it yourself if you like for free, because it's out of copyright by this point. The only thing that's different in this film, and you have to respect, I think Neil Gaiman's behind the screenplay for this as well, isn't he?
Yes, and Roger Avery, I think, isn't it?
Now, if you're going from a source that is at least 400 years old, you'd think it's probably stood the test of time. It's quite old.
Well, give or take some pocket change, put it that way.
Yeah, it's stood the test of time. Now, you've got to have some fairly big balls, big brass swinging balls, balls of steel, to think, you know what, it's not quite punchy enough, let's change it. And so that's what they've done, and the bits that they've added add very little to it, and just seem to be tinkering for the sake of tinkering, and essentially, the whole film is actually a bit dull. Of course, you can see this film in full-on 3D digital crikey vision in certain cinemas, and if you go and see that, it's the 3D effects certainly very impressive, but after about half an hour, once that's sort of sunk in and you're kind of a bit bored of it, it's pretty dull.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. It's the 3D films, from the point of view of seeing it in 3D crikey vision on a very large screen, from the gimmick point of view, it's worth watching.
Yeah, but to be honest, in the rest of it, it's not actually that impressive. I mean, the dialogue's pretty clunky. And the animation,
dialogue is terrible.
The animation really can't work out whether it's trying to be something realistic or sort of be a sort of third-rate Shrek knockoff. And a lot of the characters, the kind of third-tier characters that are from the background, look quite poor as well. It's certainly not particularly well polished, and I'm not quite sure where all the time and money's went on it. It doesn't seem to be up to the standard of what you'd expect from something like this.
Yeah, there are a few points. It's not just the animation, even the storyline. It doesn't seem to be able to decide whether it's a fantasy epic, which it should be, given its source material, or whether it's Shrek, in terms of the comedy that's in it.
Yeah, there are moments in there where it's quite... Well, I'm quite surprised at quite how salty it was for a 12-rated film.
Precisely.
How violent it was.
It's quite ribald, really, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't shy away from a bit of violence either, and it's quite sort of... I mean, people said that Casino Royale was pushing the 12 certificate with the torture scene and things like that. And well, mm-hmm. I mean, there's nobody getting whacked in the balls by a knotted rope in this, but there's people getting torn apart by monsters and...
And eaten. Yeah, and there's... There's a scene quite near the start, the first attack from Grendel, when the screen goes all flashy and blue and cold, and the stroboscopic effect. And imagine for, say, a 6 or 7-year-old, that's quite a distressing scene.
Yeah, I should imagine so.
Very surprised even by that. Before it got to the rather risque humour, that even that scene, I was wondering what the BBFC were doing, giving it a 12A.
Yeah, this is the thing that troubled me, and I thought it was quite sort of, it threw the pace off, well, not the pace off, but it kind of threw the rest of the film for me, is that fight scene initially near the start, which turns into a bit of an Austin Powers affair, where basically Beowulf is in the nuddy, and he's running about, and it's one of those jobs where every time the camera cuts to another angle, there's a sort of a conveniently placed object in the way of his wanger. And I just thought, why bother with that? Why not just give him a loincloth or something and cut the, you know... Presumably, is it meant to be funny? Is it not meant to be funny?
That's what I'm saying. It can't decide what it wants to be. I mean, if it's going to go down sort of the Shrek route, okay, but maintain it throughout.
Yes, but exactly.
It's like the rest of it's trying to be serious fantasy epic.
Well, I didn't get the feeling that bit was necessarily trying to be funny. I just thought that they were trying to stay true to the literature on that, okay, that he's supposed to be shorn of all clothing at that point, and they thought, well, there's no other way we can get about it. We can't go and show as Todger if we want to make a sort of a family-friendly film, which, obviously, well, the rest of it, I would argue, is not exactly family-friendly. But I didn't think it was done necessarily for comic purposes. I didn't get the feeling that it was supposed to be out-and-out comedy.
I don't know how you struggled to do that and not realise it was going to be funny.
I would much rather they just said, you know what, stick a docking leaf on him or a loincloth or something, and let's just stick to making a serious bloody piece of filmmaking.
That's the problem. It's got comedy in it rather than, if it's got humour and wit, that's fine. That always fits into anything. But it was going for comedy rather. It just couldn't make up its mind what it wanted to be. And the 3D effects, I mean, some of them are quite impressive, but... Yeah. Other bits are decidedly ropey. There are a few scenes where you see the king and queen sitting on their thrones, and the back of the throne looks like a flat bit of cardboard.
Maybe that's
very, very much like a flat bit of cardboard.
Do you think the whole comedy element to it then was in an effort to sort of alleviate the darker elements in order to make it more family friendly? When in actual fact, you know, I think everybody would just have appreciated it more if they'd gone for a higher rated certificate and just made it a balls out sort of in your face hack 'em up job.
Certainly, I would have appreciated that more.
Yes.
Too. Yeah.
But, I mean, they went too far, the side of the family thing, because I think a lot of parents will probably take their kids to it on the strength of the advertising, thinking, this is going to be a good adventure film. They might take a 7 or 8-year-old in, because we all know that parents, you know, parents are thick anyway, and they say, oh, 12A.
Yes.
Well, that 12 is just an arbitrary number, isn't it? It's nothing to do with how old my child should be before they can see it. I think they're going to go in and they're going to think, blimey, that's a bit strong.
Yeah, I'd agree totally. I think this is woefully miscategorised. I really cannot understand what the BBFC were thinking at all with this. I would be interested to check and see if anything's been cut.
Fantasy violence. I don't think any cuts have been applied. I think just these days the BBFC. There was a point about maybe a year or two ago where I was crediting the BBC with finally having some sort of sense and intelligence. But if anything, with these lower ratings, the 12 ratings and things they have now, I think they've gone too far the other way, and they're allowing too much through on the pretense of it being inverted commas fantasy violence. As far as I'm concerned, it doesn't matter whether something's violent in the context of a fantasy or violent in the context of the real world. It's still violence, and there's only so much a child of that age should be allowed to see in a cinema. We all know they're going to see it at home anyway. We all know that kids of like 9 and 10 are going to be watching the number one film at the box office this week, which is rated an 18. You can't stop that. People are thick, and people who shouldn't credit kids with that much maturity do credit them with it. But at the end of the day, when you go to see something in the cinema, the ratings should count, and I think they're letting stuff away with far too much on these ratings because, oh, well, yeah, but they'll have an adult with them. Cinemas don't work that way. Of course, kids who are under 12 are going to get in to see it on their own, and they shouldn't.
Yeah, so there's a few films just over the last couple of weeks I've been very puzzled about the BBFC's rating of. It seemed utterly inappropriate. This is another one. And it's like the fact that it's fantasy violence really means nothing.
Yes, exactly. Violence is violence is violence.
Yes, regardless of whether it's a CG character, a cartoon, or a genuine actor.
As though seeing a man's innards spilled out is less traumatic because of the fact it's been done by a monster rather than another human being.
Yes.
That doesn't measure up for me. But
a decade ago when Braveheart came out and it was only a 15... and people are getting their limbs chopped off left, right and centre, and I thought even then that 15 was quite a mild rating, but it's not
very mild in
a 12A for something like this.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand when the thing is, they applied the same argument to that as they did with things like Schindler's List and Private Lines, and it's a historical context. But of course, anyone who spent more than 5 minutes reading about Scottish history will know Braveheart is anything but a historical document of what shit went down back then. But even things like, obviously, Private Ryan and things like Schindler's List, I can understand entirely, but Braveheart, no. And unfortunately, Beowulf should really be a 15, I'm afraid, regardless of whether it's a bunch of pixels being torn asunder or not by monsters or otherwise. But hey, that's just me. Maybe I'm becoming a fuddy-duddy, but I don't know. If I put it this way, if I had a 12-year-old child, I would take them to see it, possibly, but I certainly wouldn't take anyone under the age of 12 to see it, having seen it myself now.
It was quite a surprise. No, quite a lot of countries seem to be given a rating around 12. South Korea given a 15. New Zealand, similar. And Singapore, so they've all done it sensibly. Whereas, very strangely, the very conservative Islamic Republic of Malaysia, or country of Malaysia, has given it a U.
Is that for unbelievers?
At number one in the top ten, Ridley Scott's latest, some say masterpiece, others say overrated, some say Oscar contender, some say mediocre, American Gangster. I haven't quite made up my mind about American Gangster yet. I have seen it. I get the feeling that I would very much like to like it, or I would very much like to love it, but I only find myself liking it. Gentlemen, are you with me on this one?
Annoyingly, that's almost exactly what I think.
Yeah, I would say about the same too. I'm undecided. I feel I should have a higher rating of it than I do.
Drew, can you fill our listeners in on the basic premise of American Gangster?
Certainly. American Gangster follows the story of a Harlem resident called Frank Lucas, who works with a general bad guy named Bumpy Johnson as his driver, enforcer, general dog's body, as he goes about collecting drug money and protection money in Harlem. After Bumpy Johnson dies, Frank, that's Denzel Washington, decides that he should set up in business for himself because he begins to get pushed around by other people wanting to take over Bumpy's business. So having applied what he's learned, he comes up with some rather ingenious methods of sourcing very pure heroin using the US Army, imports it into the United States, selling a better quality product at a cheaper price, and soon starts challenging the mafia for king of bad guys in New York. The rest of the film then follows Russell Crowe's policeman Richie Roberts, who's the head of a narcotics force investigating Frank Lucas and the mafia's drug business in New York and New Jersey in an attempt to bring them down.
This is based on a true story as well, isn't it?
Based on a true story, yes. For as much leeway as that tends to give a film.
Although both Richie and Frank were advisors on the film and were present quite a lot of the time it was being filmed, I think we can assume that some amount of artistic license has been applied here and, you know, here and there. But I mean, as I understand by and large that it is the telling of the story as very much as has happened. And
I think it's a lot closer to the true story than a lot of films.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, obviously, there are probably some elements there that are designed to make it a more interesting audience experience, but I found myself watching the film and thinking, I mean, obviously, this came with a lot of pre-release hype over here, didn't it? And I mean, I know people are mentioning Denzel Washington in terms of Oscar nominations this year, and myself, personally, I couldn't see it. I couldn't see it in Training Day, to be honest, but the less said about that, the better. I don't think this is Denzel Washington's finest performance. I don't think it's necessarily an Oscar-worthy performance. It was nice to see Russell Crowe not dumbing down, but sort of dressing down at least, and is quite authentic in terms of look and feel, but I wasn't quite as engaged as I expected to be by the film. At no point did I find myself greatly involved. I enjoyed it. I don't regret having gone to see it, but it wasn't quite the experience I was hoping for.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was okay. I did like Denzel Washington. I think he's always a very charismatic person to watch. He's a very watchable guy on screen.
Definitely, don't get me wrong.
That carried it through, and it's a good a performance from Russell Crowe as I've seen in the last 5 or 6 years or something like that.
Certainly since The Insider.
Yes, and it was watchable, and I can't really go much more than that, but yeah, I just didn't feel particularly involved by anyone. I don't know if it's the fact that, you know, regardless of it being based on a true story, it does seem like a story I've seen umpteen times before.
Yeah.
I think I liked it better when it was Scarface because it had a bit more shouting in it.
Yeah, exactly. But this is the thing, it does draw on a lot of inspirations, doesn't it? It's not necessarily, in terms of storytelling, the most original tale.
Yeah, there's only so many ways you could tell the story of a drug dealer going to the top and then somebody trying to bring him down.
Yeah,
I'd imagine the same story is repeated regardless of which country it is, which drug dealer, which policeman.
One imagines that being a sort of a major drugs baron is probably quite a profession in which you probably bump into quite a few cliches anyway. There's only so many ways it can turn out. But I don't know, there was something... No two elements of the film really fused for me. The performances were certainly ample, but they weren't spectacular. The I appreciate that there aren't too many dull moments in the film. For a film of that length, I never felt particularly bored, but at the same time, it just was one of these films where I thought I could maybe lose 20 minutes, I don't know.
See, that's the one thing, I actually was enjoying it throughout, and the running time didn't bother me. I saw this right after having seen Beowulf, and by the end of Beowulf, I was feeling slightly uncomfortable in my seat, but this is a much longer running time, and I didn't feel it at all. So the running time is one thing that wasn't a concern for me.
Yeah.
The only issue I've really got with it is that I did feel like I'd seen pretty much everything here before. I mean, it's doing it very, very well. It's all very polished, and it's all, you know...
You would expect that from Ridley, wouldn't you?
Exactly. It's all shined up to the nines, but when you, I just felt like I've seen it all before, and I just couldn't quite get into it as much.
Although in Ridley's defence here, in terms of sort of visual presentation, obviously it's a very slick production, and it looks great, it looks very authentic, but it doesn't have an over-the-top Ridley Scott element. I mean, we've seen Ridley Scott films where there are moments where it's obvious that he's sort of more preoccupied with the look of a scene than what's actually happening in it, whereas I don't think you can cite American Gangster as being guilty of that at any particular point.
Yeah.
So in that respect, anyone who's worried about, well, I'm not going to see it because it's a Ridley Scott film and he likes to throw the camera a bit about, you know, he's becoming more like his brother. But in this case, no, I wouldn't let that put you off. If you're not a fan of Ridley Scott's usual sort of visual style, this isn't as intense as some other films he's done. He's not as interested in the look here as he is, obviously, trying to make a serious story, you know, a serious piece of work. But I just, as I say, no two elements of it quite gelled for me, and it doesn't feel disjointed, but it feels a little bit unsatisfying.
Yeah, I agree completely. It's just a little bit lackluster. It just doesn't quite kick into higher gear when you expect it to.
Yeah, I mean, for me, there are more obvious Oscars. It's not been a fantastic year, but there are more obvious Oscar contenders about, which I'd be surprised if this picked up too many, if any at all. But there you go. That's our limited opinion. We're entitled to it as much as anybody.
So you... You absolutely entitled to our opinion.
Exactly. Hell, our opinion should be on the curriculum. Now, if you do fancy something at the cinema this week, which at least offers a change of pace from gangsters and scary monsters, then you may want to check out Rescue Dawn, the latest film from Werner Herzog, which tells the true tale of American pilot shot down over Laos at the start of the Vietnam War and his subsequent internment and escape therefrom. A prison in the jungle. Lads, can you offer any more info than this?
Well, the pilot in question here is Dieter Dengler, who's played by Christian Bale, who we're all big fans of around this table.
You'd better believe it.
Capture Thrawn Choke, along with Dwayne Martin, who's Steve Zahn, who is almost unrecognisable here, and another fellow called Eugene McBroom, amongst others, who's played by Jeremy Davis. They plan to escape. The guys who've been there for longer than him tend to be a slightly depleted mental state. And eventually they do. Dieter and Dwayne make their way through the jungles of Laos, trying to survive with varied outcomes. It's really quite good. I thought it's maybe not the best film you'll see this year, but I think it's got a lot to recommend in it, particularly the performances of Bale and Zahn. You can argue that maybe there's not quite the sense of danger. There never feels like they're particularly in any great peril, despite the fact that they should be, and it doesn't seem to quite come across that way, but it's certainly quite a pretty film. It moves along quite well. It's reasonably entertaining. It's pretty good.
Yeah, I would concur with that. Like you say, the only problem I had was that for something set in a prisoner of war camp in Laos, that there, as you say, there wasn't at any point any sort of great sense of jeopardy. And although at the start, where we see Dengler being beginning his internment and sort of put through numerous sort of what would normally be portrayed as horrendous tortures, they don't actually come across as being particularly horrendous. And certainly the point where he's sort of strung upside down with an ant's nest attached to him, and I think we were expecting sort of this torrent of ants to come out, and you know, when in actual fact there were like sort of two ants crawling about his face, causing him no form of inconvenience whatsoever. And I'm not entirely sure how drastic that was.
Yeah, they need to hire a better ant wrangler for the remake, I think.
Exactly. I like to think, really, if someone had just bothered to poke it with a stick, they could have got a better reaction. I mean, am I correct in saying they were probably fire ants, weren't they?
Well, I assumed it would be something like that. They didn't stop and tell me, but it looked like that's what they were going for, but not really getting anything out of it. So, Drew, what do you think?
I'm with Craig in that I'm not quite sure whether I liked it or not. It was certainly a good film, and Steve Zahn and Christian Bale are excellent, both going down the rather scary Robert De Niro method road that Christian Bale explored even more extremely in The Machinist, and they both look emaciated and seem to have gotten really, really into their roles. Which is impressive, and it certainly makes the characters a lot more believable. Although just at the back of your mind, you're thinking, jings, it's only acting. You didn't need to have gone that far.
But it
suffers from the problem you mentioned too, that there's not a great deal of a sense of ordeal to it.
Yeah.
But there's quite a lot of optimism in the film too, which is surprising.
Yeah, I mean, we mentioned that Christian Bale's character always seems sort of blithely optimistic and...
He's relentlessly upbeat.
Yes. A good characteristic to have in that sort of situation. We seem to have gone through. So,
absolutely. And from what I've read, it's actually quite like The Real Man, having been based on a true story, of course. But, I'm not sure if I enjoyed it. I'm not sure whether I'd want to watch it again, like Craig, to find out if I enjoyed it. But it's certainly interesting. And Christian Bale is just, he's always awesome.
Yeah, I mean,
I could watch him in anything.
I'll pretty much echo that. I think I said I liked it earlier on, but I think it's the kind of film that I want to like more than I actually can justify by any kind of rationale. Again, the best things about it is Christian Bale and Steve Zahn, although I should really point out that Jeremy Davis, who's Eugene, who's slightly more off-kilter than the rest of them, does very well as also, which is quite a difficult role to play because it could quite easily have gone into the slid down into a kind of comic abyss, but he manages to balance it quite well, and you do get a feeling of him having suffered quite a bit more than the rest. I thought he seems a bit more affected by it all, and I think he's kind of been overshadowed with the rest of it, but I thought he put in a very good performance also.
Yeah, I mean, his character is deeply, deeply unlikable, but it still manages to make you think, yeah, but he's been suffering for quite a long time, I'll forgive him a lot of it. You think, yeah, it's quite unpleasant, he betrays them to some extent, but there is some pity there, and you think there's perhaps an excuse for that, a reason for that, and it would be quite easy just to make him an out-and-out villain
for
all intents and purposes, but it's played quite well. You feel a sense of pity for the character.
So it's a kind of mild recommendation, I guess. I think it's a lot better than the 14 position off the top of my head where it debuted at for the box office charts. I think it deserves better than that. I think a lot more people should be seeing it than have, and I think it's a bit of a shame. However, I can't really blame them for not wanting to see it.
No. And yeah, it's just, you know, it's another Vietnam War film. There have been an awful lot of them, and not as many in the last few years, obviously. It's just a topic that's been done so often. And even though this one isn't really political, but again, it didn't need to be because every other Vietnam War film has been, but you imagine that would make people off. It's like, yeah, I don't need to watch another film that says the Vietnam War was an astonishingly poor idea.
Yeah, so I suppose it's as good a prisoner of war film as we've seen for a good couple of years because there haven't really been that many of them.
Yeah, so the last one I can really remember would probably be Heart's War.
Yeah.
Been much since then.
Which was better. So perhaps go and see Heart's War instead. Yeah, that's our recommendation. Don't bother with this. Go see Heart's War.
Oh, actually, no. If you want to see a prisoner of war film, watch The Counterfeiters.
Even better idea.
Or Heart's War. But if you still fancy that after that and you've seen The Great Escape enough times, then watch Rescue Dawn for something slightly different.
Okay, thanks to some internet gremlins, glitches and space goblins, we're going to have to cut this a little shorter than we'd intended. But just before I let you away and do something a little more interesting, I'm going to talk for a little while about Lines for Lambs. This, of course, is Robert Redford's truly risible liberal op-ed rant. He plays a college professor who's trying to talk some enthusiasm for politics into a young student representing seemingly everyone who isn't Robert Redford. While this is going on, you have Tom Cruise being a slimy politician trying to sell the next solution for the war on terror to a slimy journalist played by Meryl Streep. Of course, you can't do a film like this without being accused in some fashion of being anti-American, so to try and ward that off in a fairly cynical effort, there's two soldiers off being brave in the middle of Afghanistan and serving very little other purpose than to deflect criticism in what's a deeply cynical movie. It's fairly quickly apparent that this isn't really a film. There's no particular narrative driving through it. It's a series of vignettes of characters that Robert Redford is using as puppets to further his own political aims. It is basically Redford's polemic against the government and the press. Now, funnily enough, I don't really care what Robert Redford thinks about the Iraq War, because he's Robert Redford and not anyone in any position to do anything about it. However, Robert Redford thinks we should care what he thinks, and seemingly that the world would be a lot happier and nicer place if he ran it. Now, I don't want to give this too much attention on the basis that it's already thankfully vanishing from cinemas nationwide and hopefully we'll never have to think of it again. However, it is notable for this. If you cast your mind back to the excellent film Team America, World Police, you'll remember there's a scene where a whole host of Hollywood actors are sitting around putting the world to rights in their own inimitable fashion. Funnily enough, that scene preemptively parodies this entire film. And I think it says all you need to know about it when the actual title of the film, Line for Lambs, comes from a quote where a German general looked at the attitudes of the British troops and described them as lions led by lambs. You see, except of course, anyone who remembers their history will know that the Germans described the British troops as lions led by donkeys, because lions led by lambs wouldn't make any kind of sense whatsoever given what was going on in the First World War at the time. Now, if a film can't even get the quote it taking its title from right, what chance has the rest of it got of being right in any way, shape or form? The answer is, it doesn't. This is a truly horrible, preachy, nasty film that just emphasises everything that's bad about liberal filmmaking, if there is such a thing. It just batters you over the head with a seemingly quite immature political opinion that basically says that everyone who isn't Robert Redford is wrong about everything. It's a horrible film to watch, and we heartily recommend that you stay well, well away from it. Okay, deep, calming breaths. And we're back. Okay, thanks for letting us invade your eardrums. Hopefully you can join us next week, where we intend to look at some of the best westerns who come out in recent times. But until then, on behalf of everyone here at The One-Liner, goodbye! I think that'll do, to be honest with you.